from the ages.
The dog that buried the bone, the squirrel that gathered nuts for a later feast, the bees that filled a comb with honey, ants that laid up stores for a rainy day. It was they and other subtle creatures like them who taught our ancestors the art of providing for tomorrow out of the surpluses of today.
That is a statement contained in the book, The Story of Civilization by Will Durant.
This is Face to the Future, a new transcribed series on this station produced in cooperation with the North American Air Defense Command. Its conductor is Del Vina, well-known broadcaster, author, lecturer, a lady of adventure as well. It's Face to the Future, and here is our hostess, Del Vina.
Welcome again to Face to the Future. Throughout history, hunger has been one of the greatest driving forces of mankind. Beside it, sex, power, desire for success are all pale in comparison. Nations under the compulsions of hunger have become nomadic peoples. Even today, it's possible in a few short weeks to reduce civilized man to animal-like status, where he can think of nothing but linking sustenance with his survival. Reports of prisoners of war on low-calorie diets have confirmed this over and over, as recently as Korea's wartime action. Through the ages, says Britain's famous historian, Dr. Arnold Toynbee, this has been the case.
Man once felt impotent in face of the three classic scourges of human life, war, pestilence, and famine. An invasion by human aggressors was, for our forefathers, on a par with, let us say, an invasion by locusts. Their onset is inexorable, so there is nothing that you can do with them but to fight them. And if you fail to destroy them, they will devour your crops and thus destroy you.
Sustenance then has been closely tied to war and has been a cause of war. It conceivably could still be an incitement to war, particularly if a great population became so hungry it could be exploited and pointed in the direction of plenty and the people who possess this plenty. Much depends on rainfall and the water supply generally, the distribution of rainfall being very unequal over the arable face of the earth. I wonder if you've ever thought about the demands we make upon water. Here is George Halazon of Kansas State Agricultural College.
Of course, water is of primary interest to our nation. It's of interest to city people. It's of interest to industrialists. And, of course, everybody knows it's of great interest to the farmer. For instance, right now, the United States' daily supply of water is about 600 billion gallons of pure fresh water. During 1959, the U.S. daily need for water was 270 billion gallons of water. But the anticipated 1980 U.S. daily needs for water is 600 billion gallons, just exactly equal to our supply. For every pound of dry leaf or seed that's produced by any plant, it takes from 300 to 1,000 pounds of water. The animal bodies are between 70 and 90% water. It takes over 150 gallons of water to make a 5-pound newspaper. It takes 285 tons of water to convert iron ore to 1 ton of steel. That suture ware takes about 11,000 pounds of water to create. And what we do with our water supply is going to help us determine what our country is going to be like in the future.
Have you ever noticed how vulnerable you are to the need for water or liquids? Just to hear the mention is often enough, or to see someone heading for a drinking fountain provides some compulsion. And how many times has a radio commercial for some liquid concoction sent you in the direction of the refrigerator to see what's on tap. The want of water can cause a man to fancy he sees it so clearly in the dry desert, he may even put some sand in his mouth before he will give up the illusion for what it is, a mirage. Prophets of doom have said that should the two polar ice caps melt, the water level of the oceans would rise so high, all the coastal areas and their great cities would be inundated and destroyed. Prophets of the future see the increase in water which could result from such melting, if properly controlled, making what are presently parched deserts, produce food for our rising populations, produce the greater sustenance required to support mankind. Today's problem is that parts of the world produce in abundance and others not at all, and distribution becomes difficult to effect any kind of equality. If we could control the distribution of rainfall, the distribution of food would be automatic because marginal portions of the landmass would become productive. Water has all kinds of necessity and all kinds of fascination. My next guest is a man who's had the strangest romance I know, a lifetime love affair with the oceans. Would you identify yourself, please?
I'm Roger Revell. I'm professor of oceanography in the University of California and director of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and of the La Jolla campus of the University of California.
As an oceanographer, the sea can be seen at least two ways by you, sustenance and security. Could you enlarge on this?
The sea is just like the land in one respect, and that is that there are some areas which are very fertile and other areas which are deserts. They're watery deserts, but they're deserts in the sense that there are very few living things that exist there or produce there. At the present time, about 30 million tons of fish are caught annually in the world as a whole. I have great hope that we might increase this by as much as tenfold. Many people, as you know, have suggested that the ocean is a limitless source of food, but this is very far from the case. But it would be a very important part of the protein production.
Why can't you get more food than this?
The principal reason is the peculiar way in which animals and plants in the sea live. Everything in this earth depends upon the growth of plants, because plants are the only living things that can capture the energy of sunlight. Now, the plants in the sea, instead of looking like the grass in the field, are very small. They're microscopic in size, and they're designed so they can float in the water. The result is that the animals that eat the plants are also very small, about the size of the head of a pin. And the other animals eat those animals. Then the fish eat the animals that eat the animals that eat the plants. And finally, and it's the fish that we ourselves catch and live on. And this long process is called a food chain, and each step in the chain is very inefficient. So the result is that we really never can hope, so far as I can see, to get anywhere near the same total quantity of food out of the ocean as we do out of the land.
We hear the term sea farming now. Can we fertilize the sea and help?
It is quite right that we may very well be able in the future to increase the fertility of certain parts of the sea by adding fertilizers or growth from promoting substances to it. And if this is what you mean by farming, why, I think it will be possible, but it's not possible now in the open sea. We're still in the hunting economy, just like the primitive savage hunters of 5 or 10,000 years ago.
If there's a thing we call outer space, is not the sea a kind of inner or liquid space just as worthy of exploration for both peaceful and military purposes?
Both outer space and inner space are both parts of man's environment about which he is naturally very ignorant, principally because we've never been able either to get out into outer space or to go down into the depths of the sea. And it's just now becoming possible to do this. We're just now getting vehicles that can go down into the great depths, just as we're getting satellites and spaceships that can go out great distances from the Earth.
What are some of the benefits we might receive from better knowledge of ocean depths?
For example, a better understanding and perhaps ultimately control of climate, increasing the harvest from the sea, maintaining the defenses of the United States.
What would you say is the most important thing yet to be learned from the ocean which would increase our security?
The ocean has always been a defense for the United States. The United States is essentially a big island in the middle of the world of the world-girdling ocean. But at the present time, the ocean is liable to become an enemy rather than a friend, and this is because of the menace of the nuclear-powered, missile-carrying submarine. Submarines in the hands of a potential enemy, and the great benefit that we can gain from a military point of view in effectively operating our own submarines.
Do we have a means of detecting enemy subs?
None of the means that you use to detect airplanes can be used to detect submarines. The surface of the ocean is really an iron curtain. We can't see through it. We can't send radar waves through it. We can't use any of the ordinary detecting means when we're above the surface and a submarine is below the surface. The only way we can aim a weapon at it is acoustically, by the use of sound. But you have to know a great deal about the ocean to use sound effectively. And, of course, this works both for our own submarines trying to operate against the enemy and for our attempts to detect or to track or to destroy potential enemy submarines operating against us.
Dr. Revell, one last question. What are the implications of water on sustenance in the year 2000?
The population of human beings in the year 2000 will be pretty close to 6 billion people, more than twice the number of people we have now. And these people are likely to be desperately short of protein. And they'll just have to get this from the ocean. I would hope that by studying the ocean and studying the atmosphere, we will have learned so much more about climate that we'll be able actually to do something about climate.
Throughout history, then, man has found that his sustenance and security go hand in hand. Without food, he is weak. Without security, he is weak. And weakness invites his exploitation, subjugation, and enslavement by the merciless. Like the sea offers two choices of its bounty, we must take both, not just one. Every man has two main interests, and one of them is his security. He can choose the other, but without security, he can be sure of nothing.
This has been Face to the Future, a transcribed series on this station, produced in cooperation with the North American Air Defense Command and featuring Delvina with her parade of interesting guests. Be with us next time as we put our face to the future.